Should we get on, or...
Yes.
Look, that's a rhetorical question.
Yes, thank you very much. And play the thing music now.
Picture this. Recording studios somewhere far, far away.
I missed it because you did that.
Can we use that?
It's the Merry White House Experience.
The phenomenal world of the unexplained.
There are many things in the world which are beyond the normal limits of understanding. Poltergeists, out-of-body experiences, why anybody watches the word. Humanity has always sought for what is beyond the rational and empirical, even though conventional science had steadfastly refused to take such phenomena seriously.
Here, on the remote plains of the Turkish interior, is a graceful unicorn. No, it can't be. It must be a horse with an upside-down cornetto stuck on its nose. It's two of the camera crew in a unicorn suit. The director's put mescaline in my tea again. There's no such thing as a unicorn. Now.
There are many other mythical creatures which some claim are real. One of these, cited in the Himalayas, is the abominable snowman. The question about him is, how can a snowman be abominable?
The final assault begins. Only another 9,000 feet to the summit of Everest.
Wait, what's that?
Oh, my God. It's coming closer.
Well, what is it?
I don't know, but it's got a carrot for a nose and a crappy old scarf on. No, look, it did have a carrot for a nose, but some kids have taken it out and stuck it where its knob should be.
The abominable snowman is also known as the Yeti, a strange, hairy creature from another time. Some experts claim it may simply be a member of Status Quo who's got lost. Then, of course, there's the Loch Ness Monster. Many expeditions have sought to prove the existence of this one.
Right, so we'll set up the cameras here.
You're looking for Nessie?
Yes.
I saw her once, many moons ago, rising from the water. A terrible head, eyes, fangs. Terrible. I thought I was doomed. If you value your life, you'll be away from here and down to the top and tea room and souvenir boutique over there.
I can't keep this up. This job on a tourist board is the worst I've ever had.
Then, of course, there's psychic phenomena. So many people are interested in this field that there is actually a newspaper for them, Psychic News, which is the only paper where everybody always gets the crossword right. Ghosts have long fascinated people, and the annals of English literature contain more spirits than George Best's minibar. One famous example is A Christmas Carol, where Scrooge is visited by the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come. What they don't tell you about is the ghost of Christmas normal, a depressing spectre who comes through the wall in an ill-fitting CNA cardigan and falls asleep in an armchair with a copy of the Radio Times over his face and his hand dangling in a box of Rover biscuit assortment. Another phenomenon defying explanation is telepathy, communicating with other people via thought waves. We only use 1/10 of our brains, and some parapsychologists claim that the power of telepathic communication lies within all of us. This could form, surely, a major part of the communications revolution.
I put a nickel in the telephone and found my baby's number. Got a busy brain.
Now, the problem would be that with 56 million people to choose from, how on earth would you tune into the right brain? Well, they'd have to set up some kind of service.
Hello, Director of Inquiries. Which brain, please?
Chris Tarrant, please.
Sorry, got no brain listed under that. That'll be 50p, please.
Then, of course, there's UFOs. It would undoubtedly be brilliant if we ever did get visited by creatures from another planet, if only because we'd be able to see how the media would cover the event.
Here at Westminster, the atmosphere is electric. Several aliens came up to me in the corridor earlier and said, "We are the masters of Earth. You puny humans are powerless against our highly advanced intelligence and proton disruptor rays." But when I asked them how they would restructure the poll tax, they were stumped. Eventually, one of them said, "Aren't you John Cole? I like your coat."
One man who was obsessed with UFOs was Eric von Daniken, who in Chariots of the Gods had this theory that originally a spaceship crash-landed on Earth needing repairs, which must have been really good fun for the alien.
Oh, dear, sorry, mate. No, I can't do anything this week.
Is your magnetomodular phase field is scanning on an irregular quantum mode and your spark plugs are knackered. I mean, you're looking at least 500 of our Earth pounds. Can you afford that?
No, but I know a man who can.
So many sightings of UFOs that one is tempted to think that there must be something in it. But why do they just hover about and never make contact? The most plausible explanation is the fact that the Earth is up for sale and that intergalactic estate agents are showing people around.
There you are. As you can see, it's got 5 agents and 5 centers, 6 if you want to convert them to charter them. Spacious accommodation in this sought-after area of the solar system. Oh, by the way, the heating's broken.
If extraterrestrial beings do finally make it to planet Earth, they must be of phenomenal intelligence. The information and advice they'll be able to impart will surely be mind-boggling.
Oh, mighty visitors, welcome to Earth. Here we have pestilence and disease and pollution. Tell us, what are we doing wrong?
It is all to do with potatoes.
Sorry?
You peel them with your little metal knife. Ah, ah. You boil them for 20 minutes. Ah, ah.
And we'll have more live coverage from the GATT conference later.
Big ears, what time is it?
It's time for the Mary White House experience.
And now, the funfair experience. Funfairs are incredibly crap. Nowhere is this better exemplified than on the ghost train. It's an extraordinary idea that the ghost train is meant to be as terrifying as other things in the horror genre.
They went on a ride they would never forget. Firstly, they had to face the skeleton that was made of cardboard and didn't quite pop out at the right time. Then, the spider bought from a joke shop. The 5-year-old in the seat in front screamed sarcastically. They were forced to confront dark questions that should never be asked, like, what's supposed to be frightening about going through some double doors? And just when they thought it was all over, it was. In fact, it finished in 13 seconds.
Another common problem with funfairs is getting confused by the caravans and going to the funfair only to find out that it is in fact some gypsies. Still, you can still have a laugh.
Mom! Mom, I want to go on the pile of burnt mattresses.
Wait a minute, dear, wait a minute. We haven't even played Count the Sauce on the Child's Lips yet.
Gypsies, by the way, are always watching portable TVs plugged into their H-reg cars. But what do they think when they watch terrestrial TV?
Oh, I hate this programme. It's just not true to life. I mean, look, where are the wheels? And no one's wearing a bright nylon sweater. It just doesn't relate to me. What else is on?
Be on the lookout for a man stealing car stereos.
Oh, this is more like it. I've got 17 of them. I don't want to lose.
Anyway, let's get back to funfairs. Funfairs are never fair. As we know from the Tenants LA advert where the bloke with the big nose discovers that the coconuts are glued down. Of course, that advert isn't that realistic, as in the real world, instead of getting away with the teddy bear, the bloke with the big nose would have been taken around the back of the caravan generators and shot. They would have put one of those pellet rifles from the shoot the duck stall in his mouth and pulled the trigger, and it would have missed.
The stall that is really not fair is the darts one, where you have to hit some playing cards. The rules of real darts are, of course, incredibly simple, because otherwise Jockey Wilson wouldn't be able to play. But no one could be expected to understand the rules of funfair darts.
Jockey, you require to hit the jack and then the three and then any selection of red cards minus the total you got from the first two darts. £180 you've spent on this stall without even winning an Elvis Presley mirror.
A funfair is hedonism underpinned by the spirit of cynicism, but it is also the Dodgems. And presently I'm petitioning Parliament to introduce a Dodgems driving test.
Okay, Mr. Newman, when I tap my clipboard on the dash, I want you to press down hard on the accelerator and discover that the car doesn't go. Have a moment of blind panic, and then it starts. Backwards. At this point, I want you to ram as hard as possible into the stiff who's trying to avoid hitting any other car. Good. His glasses have fallen out.
Still, one thing that is reassuring about funfairs is that they do take a lot of care over personnel. They don't just employ anyone, you know.
Right, well, you've applied for a job working on the airborne rocket waltzer of death. I should remind you that in this post you'll be working with A, children, and B, very specialised and highly dangerous equipment. So the two things we do require of all our employees is A, a facial tattoo, and B, a criminal record.
Of course, whenever someone from the world of the funfair or the circus makes it in the legit world, at some point all his old cronies from his past turn up and try and grab a piece of the action. So surely one day this is going to happen to John Major.
I'm standing outside 10 Downing Street, where just now a multicoloured car with a whirly brass honker pulled up and two clowns got out. It was Kenneth Baker and Michael Heseltine. Oh, my God, this has turned into the news headlines. As the car pulled away, the chassis sort of moved up and down due to the axle being offset to the wheel. Ho-ho! Ho-ho! It was a Skoda. No, this really has turned into the news headlines. By the way, how do you get Brian Walden to cack his pants? Say boo.
Right, it's Correspondence Experience. Just a few more letters that have come in from listeners. Dear the Merry White Horse Experience, I know this contribution is a bit late, but I thought that you ought to know that I have a friend who used to be manager of a dry cleaners and once had to dry clean giant haystacks underwear. He said it was like trying to get chocolate sauce stains out of a marquee. Well, thank you, Johnny Simpson, of...
I thought that was a little bit horrid, actually, that one. I've got a letter here that the Dear Mary Whitearse Experience, very, very terribly witty. Just a PS on this one. What exactly is Pebble Mill?
Very fine.
This one here just says, if you're stuck over to what to buy Aunt Maud for Christmas, buy her nothing and say, oh, sorry, I thought you were dead. And Greg Morgan of Bridge End. I think a much better way of encouraging people to register for electricity shares would be to show adverts of New Kids on the Block connected up to the national grid. And that's from a guy called Paul Stutz. Now, we haven't actually got a subject for you to write in about this week, so what we want you to do instead is to send us some money. Now, don't piss about, just send us it. Checks, postal orders, foreign currency, small change, anything, so pens ready. Send your money to us, the Mary Whitehouse Experience, BBC Broadcasting House, London, W1A1AA.
And now the Channel Tunnel Experience. I was watching those shots of the Channel Tunnel now that it's finished. And I would say that the main problem seems to be that it's made out of mud, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like Klondike Peak's gold mine. But, of course, it is a very high-tech project. Engineer in charge, Peter Jones.
Well, the special Channel 127 high-speed train that we've designed to carry the modern trans-European commuter is, in essence, a waist-high, open-top little cart full of nuggets. It's powered by a donkey. Mr. Tony Adams.
Although for a lot of people the Channel Tunnel still seems a strange idea, it should be remembered that the concept of a lot of cars along the seabed is not that alien to big travel operators. In fact, the architect got the original idea... No, in fact, the architect got the original idea from P&O Ferries.
They wanted to turn into a huge pressure cooker. The main anti-Channel lobby at the moment is Kent villagers, who, with all the interest that there is in the Channel Tunnel, are very concerned about the idea of a high-speed train rattling past their front window every 5 years.
Yeah, and by the way, all these Kent villagers worried about their lifestyle being destroyed, I mean, that's a real tragedy, isn't it? I mean, what will England be without those endless days of incest and unreported strokes? Recharge cricket and I'm on first names with the postman bollocks.
But the fact remains that since they made that breakthrough last week, we are now connected to the landmass of Europe for the first time since the Ice Age. And incidentally, what happened when we did split off that last time from Europe?
Boy, George, come back! Boy, come along!
Oh, blimey. What a lot of sea. Hang on, what's happened to my breath? It smells all garlicky. And my hair's gone all lank, and there are some strange restriction happening around my throat so that I've got a voice which by itself sounds funny to English people. Oh, no. And I feel as if soon I'll think crap things are really good. Hang on. Oh, that's good.
The most important question about the Channel Tunnel, though, is can you turn off it into Stingray Command Base? And is Troy Tempest the man to turn to if there is a disaster?
Hello, Control. Come in, Marineville. I'm having difficulty getting into the tunnel from the sea because the concrete walls are 6 meters thick and Stingray is 4 inches long and made of plastic. Also, because I'm actually in Jerry Anderson's bathtub.
I don't know if anyone remembers the ending credits of that show, but it had a shot of Troy Tempest with the beautiful mermaid Marina on a balcony under the moonlight, and then it cut to them in a quiet restaurant having a romantic meal, and then Marina got offended because it was fish.
Right, and now the local news experience. In the past few months, what with the Gulf and the leadership crisis, it's been a bit of a thin time for local newspapers.
By and large, local papers stick to local subjects. They love sordid stories. The local Cub Scout leader is usually electronically tagged so they know when he's gone into a public lavatory. Also, when it comes to road accidents, local papers have the edge over the nationals because they're able to tell exactly where it happened in pinpoint detail.
It was on the corner of Nutley Lane and Upper West Street, was it? Yeah, I always said that was a dangerous junction. Especially since I kicked over the keep left sign on the way home from the pub.
Then, of course, there's local TV news. These are extraordinary programmes, and what's worse is that current government plans for broadcasting suggest more local TV in the form of community programmes.
Good evening, and here is tonight's news from Jerningham Street, SE11. The couple in number 14 have been arguing again. We think he may have walked out, we're not sure. The Pennington's cat has been run over by the bloke at number 12. Please find an ear in the bumper. The mad old buffer from number 39 has been shouting at the traffic again. Mrs. Harker says he ought to be put away, we've a report. Plus, the paperboy tells us about the funny man at number 16 and what he asked him to push through his letterbox.
No one pays any attention to local news. People watching a local news programme generally say things like,
oh, what is she wearing? Look at that brooch. I mean, some costume person should have told her. Oh, it's him. What's his name? Oh, isn't that our town hall? Oh, look, it's the 171. I got one of those the other day. Who's this old fool? What's that bit about Croydon? Oh, look, isn't that what's his name's boy? You know, Cliff Mitchamore. Ah, that's how he got the job. The other thing about local programmes is that all the presenters have exactly the same standard TV presenter accent, and the man in the Tyne Tea studio sounds exactly the same as the one in the South West. I think it would be much more interesting if local programmes used as many regional stereotypes as possible.
Good evening, and here be the news from the South West. The harvest be in, and right fine it be. Tomorrow's weather, well, cows be lying on the ground, so stormy weather will be found.
Sorry, that was a genuine clip off Southwest News there. it's very interesting to note, actually, that the West Country accent is the only British accent that it is impossible to take seriously. There are no famous people with West Country accents, or if they are, they tend to do totally non-vocal things, like Daphne du Maurier or Thomas Hardy. The only exception to this rule was the Wurzels, who made a determined effort to get away from the cliched Somerset stereotype with such classic songs as I Am a Cider Drinker and I've Got a Brand New Combine Harvester.
Now, through history, there have been many ways of transmitting news. The news of the Spanish Armada, for example, was transmitted by a series of bonfires across the country. Did they use this technique for all news stories?
And tonight, the King announces that he will review the window tax. We have this report. Abroad now, and the French threaten an invasion. Our foreign correspondent reports. And if that was the case, what was the Great Fire of London? I mean, was it an actual event, or was it just an extended 9 o'clock news?
Also, of course, a lot of news was relayed by town criers, but even then, different criers work for different news organisations.
Oh, yes, oh, yes. King Henry to divorce Anne Boleyn and marry a third wife. Full report on scroll 2.
Oh yes, heirless Harry wields his chopper and loses the head as Randy Roger in Royal says, I'll make it 7.
Oh yes, villagers with straw roofs panic in the wake of Thatcher's resignation.
All right, it's punchline competition now. What did the last hostage say to Saddam Hussein on leaving Iraqi airport? Here we go, first one. And we still didn't wait as long as at Gatwick. Austin T. Thompson, I like that. Austin T. Thompson of Thompson Holidays. What did the last hostage say to Saddam Hussein on leaving Iraq airport? No, honestly, Iraq has always had a population of one. Very clever, that one, you see. And it's from Chris Fazzuni, who's put a PS. PS, I didn't take your advice and use the prize money to buy a new name last time. I brought a pair of stepladders instead. Enjoy the show, I'm robbing your flat. Well, Chris... I have to say that Chris is sus because it's a basement flat. So, what did the last officer say to Saddam Hussein on leaving Iraqi airport? Stop pushing in. That's my personal favourite, I think. Isn't that good? It's goodbye from me and hello from the Desert Rats, American Marine Corps, the Royal Navy, US Navy, Royal Air Force, US Air Force. That's from David Williams, who's like, reads those gun magazines in here. You've been patient, you've been glossy, you've been surprisingly subtle. I've enjoyed being fabulous with you, thank you. And that's from Stephen Fry. well observed stuff there. What did the last hostage say to Saddam Hussein on leaving Iraq airport? Oh, thanks a bloody lot for leaving me to last. I'm going to get a really bad seat on the plane now. Quite good, really, wasn't it? That's quite good. And that's from How Am I Meant to Know They Haven't Got on the Plane Yet? Now I'll have to pay my poll tax. And that's from the girl whose jeans you signed. Oh, well, we don't need to know who that's from. So I think the winner is between Stop Pushing In and what was another one that was good? Gatwick. Oh, Gatwick. Yeah, I thought there's a lot of people murmuring Gatwick. So I think the people's vote is Gatwick. So the one of... So Stop Pushing In. No, actually, those people threatened me at the end of last week. So the winner is Stop Pushing In. Big hand of applause for them.
And now, from the Congress Theatre, Eastbourne, the second of the Merry White House Experience Christmas Pantos, Jack and the Beanstalk.
Hello, children. I'm the narrator. And whenever I come on, I want you all to run around the aisles and not listen. Why? Because I've hardly ever been on the telly. I'm going to show you some of the characters in our little play. I was in Softly Softly once. Anyway, here comes our sprightly, chirpy hero, Jack.
Well, I'm very happy with the way the island played in the first half. Not really knock long balls, threw a long ball, hoofed up the field. Made the game incredibly dull and all about throw-ins.
Oh, and who's this? Oh, children, whenever this man comes on, you all have to shout behind you. So quickly now, 1, 2, 3.
Behind you!
Yes, it's Frank Warren. And now, here comes Ed Stewpot Stewart. And I want you to shout the same thing when he asks his question.
Where are the best years of my career?
Behind you!
Good.
One day, Jack's mother asked him to take her only cow to the cattle market. So off set Jack and his cow. It was the same cattle market where Jack learnt to speak.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. There'd be no place for Maradona in the island.
25.
Well, actually, mine's a fraction larger than Bobby's.
Sadly, this led to a dreadful misunderstanding. 45 sold to the pissed-off-looking man in the flat cap some beans.
I can't sell a cow for some beans. That's less than I'd get for Neil Quinn.
Well, let me explain. With an average cow, there's about 200 weight of meat. We hive off the top side and crate it to Smithfield. The offcuts have local distribution to the High Street Butcher, and the remaining chaff can be recycled into livestock feed. Now, what you've sold me here is a pantomime cow. We still started the process of hiving off the top side, but I can tell you now, it led to the deaths of two homosexual drama students.
I wondered why its milk tasted so funny.
Well, what a mix-up. Now Jack has to go back and face his mother, the pantomime dame, played by Robert De Niro.
You swap my cow for some beans? Did you sell my cow? What do you want to do? I can't believe what you've done. I'm going to shoot you.
Oh, no, you're not.
Oh, yes, I am. Don't you ever, ever, you never, ever, you ever sell my cow for some beans. See, I'm going to, if I ever sell my cow for some beans, I'm throwing them away. Jesus, who'd you buy the beans from? Ben Johnson.
Up and up the plant went, higher and higher, till it looked like this stepladder we've covered in green crepe paper. Jack ran away from his mother and climbed up it, up and up, until he reached the home of the huge giant.
Jockey, you require 45.
3, 5, 4. Fum, I smell.
Jack saw his chance to steal the giant's golden goose.
I've got a goose that lays a golden egg.
He grabs it and climbs back down the beanstalk. But the giant sees him and runs after him. Jack gets to the bottom first and chops down the stalk. The giant is dead. Everyone is pleased that the beanstalk is fallen, except for this man.
What have you done? What, son? You think grows here anymore, and you bear patch up ears every day.
Oh, sorry, son. I didn't realize that this was part of the rainforest.
Rainforest? I'm talking about my head. I look like your brother.
Oh, hang on, Sting. The goose, it's laying something. A golden egg.
Yes. And soon people flocked from miles around to the golden egg. And afterwards they would go away saying, I'm not eating there again. The cups and saucers were see-through. The cappuccino was just some froth on top of tea. The staff was made up of 4 Armenians, and you could only tell them apart because each had a different genetic defect. The only other people in there were some pensioners under the impression that it was a bit of a classy joint. And now we end, as ever, with a mind pop song.
Girl, you know it's true.
You've been listening to The Merry White House Experience. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rod Newman, Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis. The address to send your money to is us, The Merry White House Experience, Radio 1, BBC Broadcasting House under W1A1AA, and the producer was Armando Iannucci. Thank you.
Hello, Philip Schofield here. This week, going live on Radio 1, Charlie of TV's Biker Grove has just released her debut single, We Find Out.